rent was a big expense. There are all sorts of other expenses in this business, and each one of them is going to be looked at very, very carefully.
A judge approves the sale of Alaska Dispatch News to the Binkley family. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Anchorage medic mobilizes to help residents of Houston.
We actually found a mission we didn't know that we were going on, and it ended up being a pretty fabulous thing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, their financial investment and partnership with local companies at Point Thompson, helps contribute to Alaska's economy and jobs for Alaskans. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
A bankruptcy court judge today approved the sale of Alaska Dispatch News, the state's largest newspaper, from Alice Rogoff to the Binkley family of Fairbanks. The judge still needs to sign the official paperwork on the deal, which is set to close on Friday. After no other bidders step forward today, the Binkleys will get the newspaper for $1 million, an amount they already paid in the form of an emergency loan last month to keep the newspaper running. But the bankruptcy proceedings have had some twists and turns. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove is here to explain. Hi, Casey.
Hi, Lori.
Today's hearing was actually scheduled to be an auction, right?
That's right. Basically, right up until the last second, it was set to be an auction between the Binkleys and maybe any other bidders that would come forward. And the point of that is that another bidder might drive the price higher, and that would mean that the sale price would be higher and these businesses might have a better chance of getting paid, because we're in bankruptcy court here and there is no money basically left to pay them.
But the only bidder was the Binkleys?
Well, there was another bidder approaching today's hearing, and they pulled out at the last second, leaving just the Binkleys. So the auction turned into basically a judge just trying to decide if this was the right thing to do.
This took hours to sort out. Why did it take so long?
Well, once it went from auction to the judge approving a sale to the Binkleys, the judge and a federal trustee had to make sure that Rogoff hadn't made some kind of shady deal with the Binkleys just to get out from under the lawsuits for the money that the ADN owes. And that's for back rent and wiring at what was supposed to be a new printing facility and other costs. But the judge and this trustee also wanted to know that Rogoff and her associates had done everything they could to sell the paper. There was a lot of talk about sort of the general decline in revenue for newspapers and how pretty much nobody else was willing to take the risk that the Binkleys are taking on now.
Did Alice Rogoff testify?
She did, and so did a man that she hired to help shop the paper to potential bidders. In the end, as the judges described it, and as Alice and her associate described it, there were some, quote, nibbles, but the newspaper was not able to get any serious bites or land the proverbial fish. That is, except for the Binkleys.
Did Alice Rogoff say anything outside of the court when you were there today?
Not really. There were some pleasantries exchanged. At one point, several other reporters and I walked alongside Rogoff as she was leaving court during a break. You can hear here the court's metal detector as we went out the door.
How are you doing with all this?
Best as can be.
Do you have any, comment just about things got to
I have no comment.
Anything to say to the employees?
Nothing to say.
How about all the readers of the paper?
Of course, the paper's operation is a big deal to people, and many are pointing to Alice Rogoff for putting that in jeopardy. But there's also the issue of the livelihoods of something like 200 employees who are still not sure if they're going to have jobs in the near future. What do you know about that, Casey?
Well, Ryan Binkley seems to be running the show for the family in terms of buying and, at least for now, operating the newspaper. He says they have no plans to stop printing the newspaper and getting it to readers' doorsteps or to newspaper boxes. But as for jobs, Binkley says they have no immediate plans to lay off staff. He didn't rule it out, though. And he acknowledged that payroll is a large expense for the operation, and fewer staff might mean fewer reporters, and that in turn might mean the ADN's coverage will suffer. I asked Ryan Binkley if it's inevitable that staff will get laid off, and this is what he said.
I don't know that as I stand here today, but payroll is a big expense. There are a lot of big expenses. Rent was a big expense. There are all sorts of other expenses in this business, and each one of them is going to be looked at very, very carefully. There's no magic bullets here. You know, there's revenue on one side and there's expense on the other, and both need to be affected. We need to turn around the revenue decline, and we need to work on lowering the expenses.
Later, Binkley refused to say whether he thought Rogoff had mismanaged the paper or if it was just sort of these normal market forces that are causing a decline in revenue for papers around the country. He did say he expects some challenges, and he testified in court today that he'd been discovering new problems every day, pretty much. But he did express a sense of optimism. The Binkleys really do seem to want to do the right thing here. They're an Alaska family. They're from Fairbanks. And they seem to have placed a high value on a local newspaper here in Alaska in general. But, you know, keeping the paper in Anchorage, the name might change. But they seem to want that to continue. And that includes daily operations, whether the staff size stays the same, that's still in question. But we'll know more here in the coming weeks.
All right. Thanks so much for tracking that story and going to the courthouse today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That was Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reporting. In the ongoing effort to curb overdose deaths from opioids like heroin, police across Alaska are being trained to use a new tool, naloxone, a medication that rapidly reverses the effects of an opioid overdose, has long been used by emergency medics, but now it's being deployed to police departments and nonprofits at the front line of the state's opioid crisis. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, even with millions of new federal dollars being spent, the demand is outpacing the supply.
A room full of police listen as Lieutenant Steve Adams shows them how to use Narcan, a brand of naloxone that comes in a small bottle you could fit inside of a purse or a jacket pocket. Adams shows how to properly use the nasal spray if somebody's overdosing.
So the signs of an overdose include their face is going to be clammy to the touch, the body's going to be limp, fingernails and lips turn blue.
Adams works on drug enforcement with the state troopers, but his audience today is from a patchwork of agencies. The training is part of a push to get more doses of naloxone to people who are often the first ones to find somebody overdosing.
So what do? Turn them on their back, tilt their head back, support the neck with the hand, insert the tip into their nostril. Doesn't matter, left or right, it's going to get there. Press it, make sure it's all out, and call 911. And then roll them over into this rescue position.
Naloxone blocks opioid receptors in the brain and almost immediately counteracts an OD, although it may take several doses. There are almost no negative side effects, even if it's given to somebody by accident who isn't actually on opioids. The medication has been around since the 60s and widely used by medical professionals. But now, public health and addiction recovery advocates want to make it as common as defibrillators or EpiPens. That is, a simple medical intervention the public knows how to use. And Adams says state troopers are in a perfect position to help give the mandatory 15-minute trainings to dispense Narcan in communities across Alaska.
Our goal is to provide it to every Alaska state trooper and to provide it to every other agency, federal, state, and local, who would like to have it.
One of those agencies is the police and fire department at the Ted Stevens International Airport. Sergeant Daniel Juarez says at least once a month, officers will find somebody who's overdosed on a nearby roadway or in a terminal bathroom before a flight.
Well, a lot of times we're going to be there usually before paramedics. And, you know, the sooner that we can administer possibly a life-saving treatment, you know, we'd like to do that. And that's just another tool for us.
The governor's disaster declaration on the opioid crisis, along with a legislative bill last year, have increased access to the medication. Nonprofits like My House and Wasilla distribute Narcan kits. The Alaska AIDS Assistance Association, which runs the state's largest needle exchange, has given out hundreds of them and routinely requests more. Even nurses and security guards from the Anchorage School District were recently trained. Narcan isn't cheap. Over the counter at a pharmacy, it costs about $150 for a two-dose pack. But the state buys that same amount for half the price, using federal money from the Department of Health and Human Services through a $4.2 million grant. The kits are given out to individuals for free. Andy Jones helps administer the grant. He says the state originally aimed to distribute 5,000 Narcan kits this year.
Since February 15th, we have distributed 6,300 kits, and the pace continues to get faster and faster because more and more overdose response programs and communities are coming online.
Gathering the data is difficult. Jones says so far they've counted at least 39 saves, but those figures depend on medics, police, or volunteers submitting a form that says they used Narcan. Jones admits there are likely a lot of people administering the medication and not generating a record. In 2016, an estimated 88 Alaskans died from an opioid overdose. In the state's largest city, paramedics with the Anchorage Fire Department remain one of the main bulwarks against overdoses. According to figures from AFD, since the start of the year, they've used naloxone an average of 35 times a month, more than once a day. But they can't access the same federal grant as the state and use their budget to pay for the increasingly used medication. AFD Assistant Chief Eric Schuneman says last year the department spent just over $14,000 on naloxone. This year, they'd almost hit that amount by the end of the summer. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Two Alaska tribes have submitted applications to place lands into trust with the federal government. Fort Yukon wants to put just under 2 acres where a tribal government office and cultural center are located into federal trust. The village of Nanilchik has requested placing the location of its transit facility, a 2.5-acre lot, into trust. The land is located within the Kenai Peninsula Borough. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is taking public comment on the applications until October 5th. An Alaska Department of Law release says the state is taking public input on effects including the local tax rolls and potential land use conflicts until September 22nd. The requests are the latest of several filed since December 2014 when the Obama administration revised the law to give Alaska tribes previously excepted from the option to place lands into trust. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska teens press the state to do more to address climate change.
It can't be delayed any further. Like, this is an issue that gets worse.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
All eyes were on Hurricane Irma over the weekend, but not too many days ago, the focus was on Harvey and the devastation in Texas. Anchorage resident Teresa Gray is a medic who was inspired to form a relief organization called Mobile Medics International after she helped Syrian refugees in Lesbos, Greece last year. Gray and one of her teams recently returned from Houston, where they found the greatest need was in areas where undocumented immigrants were living.
And they will not come out of their neighborhoods or go anywhere or to anybody that even resembles something government. And so these people had had no help at all because they didn't leave, they didn't shelter, and they're in the lower-lying areas of Texas. So their houses got completely engulfed, like nothing is salvageable. They're terrified to go to shelter. They're terrified to ask any government organization for any kind of help. They wouldn't go to a local clinic because they were afraid they were going to ask for documentation. Because we're mobile medics, we took the medicine to them. And through an interpreter, the first thing we said, we went door to door. And the first thing we would say to them is, no names, no documentation, free medical. We just need to know if you need help. You don't even have to tell us who you are. And by doing that, it sort of one neighborhood told the next neighborhood, which told the next neighborhood, and then we were in pretty high demand. So we actually found a mission we didn't know that we were going on, and it ended up being a pretty fabulous thing.
What parts of Houston were you in? What neighborhood areas of the city? And what were the biggest needs that you found going door to door?
We ended up about an hour or so right outside of Houston. There's kind of a Hispanic neighborhood area about an hour, I think it was north of Houston. And the biggest need we saw is that people lost the ability to monitor themselves. So my diabetics didn't have their glucometers, and the people with high blood pressure didn't have their blood pressure cuffs, and they had lost their medication. This area, like I said, is kind of low-lying, and the neighborhood sloped towards the water. So the bottom half of the street, you know, the water came up so quickly that they literally ran up the street to escape the water and lost everything. And then eventually the water engulfed everybody's houses, even higher up the street. So everybody sort of lost their medication. So it was basic medicine. They were afraid their blood pressure was out of control because they'd lost their medication. They couldn't monitor it, and they were under a lot of stress. Nobody was eating properly because they didn't have the food resources that they had before. So my diabetics were getting into trouble. So one of the things that Mobile Medics does, and the reason that we sort of self-fund at this point, is when people donate to my organization, I take it really, really seriously that $20 you handed me does not pay for my plane ticket. What it pays for is a new glucometer for that lady who lost hers. So the donations that I received from this trip, you know, we bought glucometers and we bought people medication and we bought blood pressure cuffs and we passed out things as needed. So I made sure that the money went directly to people who needed it.
You mentioned that you're going to be deploying people to St. Bart and St. Martin Islands. Tell us about when that trip will take place, and then are you going to be sending people to Florida?
When we were in Houston, I actually sent a team member to Haiti to kind of assess that situation to see if the hurricane was going to hit there, because we were prepared to go from Houston to Haiti, and it missed Haiti, luckily. And then we thought about just kind of flipping over to Florida, which a lot of the NGOs have done. But honestly, as I look at the amount of support that's pouring into Florida, the American people respond beautifully, honestly, to natural disaster. And they're really good about supporting themselves. The Americans are really good about being able to pick themselves up. And it's these little tiny third world countries that sort of get left in the wake. And so I honestly think that we'd probably be better served going to those little Caribbean islands. So we probably will not be going to Florida.
Teresa Gray is the founder of Mobile Medics International. Links to their site is at our website, alaskapublic.org. Fall enrollment is down at most University of Alaska campuses. Early numbers show the UA headcount off 4.5%, or more than 1,000 students from last fall. The highest declines are at the Southeast and Fairbanks campuses. University of Alaska Fairbanks Director of Institutional Research Ian Olson says enrollment is dropping at the UAF campus as student retention and graduation rates rise.
We're graduating fairly large classes and we're getting fewer incoming students, and so our replacement rate is down. Our first-time freshman enrollment numbers are down.
Olson says it's natural for enrollment to level back coming off a recessionary bump, but the UA system is seeing the decline continue and even increase.
To some degree, we have to recognize that it is linked to uncertainty related to Alaska's economy and really the budget cycles coming out of Juneau and the legislature. That's uncertainty, we think, is causing some students to consider enrollment elsewhere.
Olson notes there is an increase in the number of UAF community and technical college students this fall, something he says may correspond with a slight uptick in local unemployment.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
In Alaska, two-thirds of people who leave prison end up going back within 3 years. But former inmates who can find decent jobs within a year of release are half as likely to reoffend. So how does the Department of Corrections want to cut recidivism? by teaching the trades. From the Solutions Desk, Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman checked in on the class.
So what we're going to do is take less than about a 16th of an inch off the lip of this.
Wesley Nickel picks up a thin slat of wood he's using to build a planter box, then slides it into the saw. He's worked in construction before, but he's never done such highly precise carpentry work. It's just one of the many skills he's trying to learn as he nears the end of his sentence at Wildwood Correctional Center in Kenai. Nickel says it's an important supplement to the substance abuse treatment he's received.
To be able to come here and do the hands-on woodwork, welding, and stuff to keep my hands busy, I feel ready to go on the out, you know, to be a productive when I get out compared to before I was just getting released and being relatively aimless.
Nickel has been in and out of prison for about 12 years, mostly for drug-related crimes. He developed an addiction to opioids after a couple of severe injuries. In the past, he was released without feeling like he developed any skills or support systems in prison.
The last time I got out looking for work, getting turned away multiple times, it got extremely frustrating. And after so long, I just kind of gave up and went back to what I knew.
Which is what Department of Corrections staff, like vocational instructor Tim Ward, are trying to prevent. 2 years ago, Wildwood didn't offer much to help prepare people for release.
So this building used to be a storage area, so it was just full of racks with pallets of just junk.
So. Now it has a new classroom, a small area for carpentry work, and metalworking tools. Ward has them building practical items that can be used, like sheds and barbecue grills. They even built the booths that they learned to weld in. Participants can earn national certifications, too.
The whole hope is that they can get out of prison, get a job, and not come back. And this is the tool for that.
Wildwood Superintendent Shannon McLeod says the vocational education program is just an example of ways corrections institutions across Alaska are trying to be more than just punitive warehouses for people. There's a push for more programs in every state prison that help inmates develop the skills they need to reenter society and stay there.
The whole idea of incarceration has changed. And I think that people realize these people are going to get out of jail. What can we do to put out a better product than what we received? So let's work with them. Let's get them out. Let's try to help them not come back. I mean, that's our motto.
She says the idea behind the vocational education classes was to give people viable skills to seek jobs. But the program is accomplishing a lot more.
They're different when they're over there. I mean, they're like men. They're not like these punk kids because they know that's what they're supposed to be over there. Grow up, you know, get a skill, move on.
And moving on is exactly what Nickel is doing. When we meet again, 1 month after I interviewed him in prison, it's at a bustling coffee shop in South Anchorage. He released from Wildwood a week earlier. Through his family, he's already received some job offers based on the certifications he earned at Wildwood.
It helps. It makes me a lot more confident while I'm job searching, that's for sure.
He also has a full ride to college starting in January, thanks to the help of his native corporations. Nickel says it's the first time in 6 years he's released from prison, prepared and sober. And he actually wants to stay that way.
Now, like, I spontaneously smile. I spontaneously catch myself laughing because it's hard to believe it's real sometimes.
He takes a sip of his coffee, prepared to look for a job and move on with his life. He says he's scared, but ready. From the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
In September, the Solutions Desk is focusing on ideas for success after prison. Share your thoughts at alaskapublic.org/solutions. The last serious effort to create a statewide climate change policy for Alaska happened under former Governor Sarah Palin. Now a group of teenagers is trying to push the issue. They hand-delivered a petition to the state's Department of Environmental Conservation recently, asking for reduced carbon emissions and a strategy moving forward. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
17-year-old Seb Curlin is homeschooled in Juneau and grew up in the capital city. But Seb says the landscape around town looked different not that long ago. The Mendenhall Glacier continues to shrink. Every year, there seems to be less and less snow. And as Seb has gotten older, this teen's concern about the changing environment has grown too.
You know, one of the hard things, especially about being a teenager with these concerns, is that you don't feel like you can do anything about it. And I found Alaska Youth for Environmental Action.
Alaska Youth for Environmental Action is part of the Alaska Center, an environmental nonprofit. The program engages teens across the state to voice their opinion on issues like climate change. In late August, Seb flew to Anchorage to hand-deliver a petition to Larry Hartig, the commissioner at the state's Department of Environmental Conservation. Seb was joined by 18 other teens, and they asked the state to fulfill an obligation to protect its natural resources.
Basically, what we're saying with this petition is, hey, you're not doing that.
The petition asked the state to reduce its CO2 emissions, monitor what greenhouse gases it does emit, and come up with a climate change strategy for the long haul. The carefully crafted legal document didn't just come out of nowhere. Back in 2011, a group of Alaska teens filed a lawsuit that made it all the way up to the state Supreme Court. But the justices ruled that it was a matter for the executive or legislative branch.
Now, you know, kind of our reply or our response is that that's the reason why we are in court in the first place.
That's Brad DeNoble, a lawyer from Eagle River who helped craft both the lawsuit and the current petition. He says the state may be obligated to do more to address climate change under a common law with ancient roots called the public trust doctrine.
Certain resources are essentially so important to society that they've got to be protected. They're incapable of private ownership.
DeNoble says the atmosphere in Alaska is the resource that needs to be protected from harmful emissions like CO2. It's a concept, he says, that's even embedded in the Alaska Constitution. But Representative Chris Birch, a Republican and freshman member of the House Resource Committee, doubts regulating industry further would do much good. Birch thinks climate change is cyclical, not just caused by people. And while he applauds the youth's civic engagement, he says there's more than one way to look out for Alaska's future.
You know, certainly, the oil and gas industry in Alaska has led to tremendous benefits for each and every one of our citizens and our residents, and I think that to compromise that or to try to put a lid on that or to try to to burden that development is not reasonable.
Seb Curlin, the teen from before, doesn't see it that way. Curlin says climate change is jeopardizing the state's other economic drivers, like tourism and fishing. And it's something the Alaska legislature needs to address now.
It can't be delayed any further. Like, this is an issue that gets worse.
The Department of Environmental Conservation has until September 29th to respond to the petition, at which point it can reject it or call a public hearing. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Kenai, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.